Welcome to the Brainstorm episode 114. We have Shay with us today to break down, I think, one of the most exciting and tractable genomics topics to date, in that at our Friday Brainstorm, people understood what was going on. And that's thanks to your explanation, Shay, which is should not be discounted. And so what you brought up was gene editing cures that are not just treating rare diseases, but potentially tackling one of the leading killers in the US. Can you talk about what happened? And then I have a lot of follow-up questions to understand where this actually is.
Yeah, perfect. Maybe I can just set it up with some context just to illustrate the importance of this transition that's happening in the space. So about 2 years ago, actually almost to the day and somewhat, regulators here in the US, so that's the FDA, approved what is known as Casgevy. And Casgevy was the first ever CRISPR-based gene editing therapy. And so this was approved for sickle cell disease. So this was a real landmark event that was shown to be safe and provide a functional cure for patients with sickle cell disease. The thing to note with Casgevy is that this is an ex vivo gene editing treatment. So what that means is that you edit the cells outside the body. So this creates a treatment journey for a patient where they'll have to go through eligibility evaluation, collection of cells, have those edited, manufacturing. The patient will have to go through chemotherapy conditioning, and this is to create space in the bone marrow to give them back the edited cells, receive the infusion, and then have a recovery period. So all of this can take up to a year, depending on how many rounds of cell collection a patient will need. So that's a considerable treatment journey for a patient to go through. So there's a critical step or a critical transition that's occurring in the space that's something to not sleep on. And that transition is going from ex vivo, so the editing outside of the body, to in vivo, which means you're editing the cells within the body. So what's fueling this transition is advances in something known as lipid nanoparticle delivery. So basically what that means, or the way you can think about it, is basically a little fatty bubble that has the editing components inside of it that will deliver it to a target cell. And this target cell is within the liver, so a liver cell that will then take it up, translate it into a protein that will actually make the edit in the cell there. So this can basically truncate dramatically the treatment journey, right? Because this could be potentially given as just a single outpatient infusion. So this is a real dramatic shift in the space that could potentially really transform this opportunity to target rare diseases to very prevalent common diseases. And the example that I'll go through, it happens to be an extremely common disease. In fact, the world's leading killer, it's cardiovascular disease. I think it's a really interesting case study to highlight the importance of this transition in this space. So
before you get there, so it's like, if you're doing ex vivo, particularly for like the Casgevy example, the conditioning you have to go through is almost like preparing for a bone marrow transplant, or, you know, it's a very involved, long process that requires your cells to get extracted. They have to get manipulated. They have to be treated very carefully because you can't introduce them into the person's body with any kind of impurities. And so it makes it operationally complex. It makes the patients have a much bigger decision that they have to make. And then it just takes, so it introduces a lot of commercial friction. Whereas with a in vivo therapy, at least with lipid nanoparticle, it's like getting an injection over a couple of hours. So it goes from, you know, and maybe you're going a couple of times, but it goes from like a year-long treatment journey to kind of like, maybe it's certainly an outpatient procedure, and it could be, you know, an appointment at a doctor's office as opposed to almost like surgery type prep.
That was one of my questions. How many shots, how often are we talking?
So for both, the infusion of the actual treatment is intended and designed to be just a single round, single treatment. So that's true for both Casgevy in terms of the infusion and in terms of also with new in vivo treatments. The difference is that you don't have to go through multiple rounds of collecting cells from a patient to edit outside of their body then give them a very rigorous, burdensome conditioning chemotherapy treatment to prepare them to receive the treatment. So that's the fundamental shift. You're taking away that entire burden for a patient.
And then before moving on here, Casgevy was like put on as a massive success for CRISPR, and we thought this was going to be a huge market. Has our thinking changed there because it's so painfully frictitious to get customers? Like, are we saying it's like, okay, it's like, yes, it's amazing, but actually we're punting on it because it's so hard to convince people to do because it kind of sucks?
No, it's still amazing. This is still a very revolutionary, incredible option for a patient to take. I think the difference is, you know, grounding expectations and understanding that this is a treatment journey that can take up to a year. And not only that, you have to set up authorized treatment centers to even provide this. So there's a cadence and time that's required to actually get the commercial ramp going. So, you know, it's been approved for about 2 years now. And, you know, a bulk of that is just getting geared up to actually provide this treatment. So it's very groundbreaking and important for patients.
Shay, does time equal money in this scenario? As in, if you're shortening the treatment window from a year to one or two shots or however many it takes, does that lower the cost of the total treatment?
So I think the best way to think about in terms of treatment costs is generally it's commensurate or intended to be with the value it provides the system, right? So in terms of you thinking about it in terms of money, in terms of for the company, well, you can more quickly treat more patients, right? So you're covering more time on patent. So that's very valuable from the company's perspective.
But the cost to the individual patient, we don't know that yet.
Well, we don't have any improved in vivo therapies just yet. Okay. But it'll also be, it won't be just you have a, you know, a phone that is set at some price and then applies to everybody. It'll be very disease and indication specific. So it'll be commensurate with the value it provides.
Okay.
Helpful. All right. All talk right. about cardiovascular
disease. Yeah, take us in.
All right. So let's take a look at cardiovascular disease as this case study example. So what is this, right? So when, in cardiovascular disease, you can have the situation where there's lipids, and lipids you can think of as the fat and fat-like molecules. So bad cholesterol, triglycerides, and they can accumulate in artery walls, right? And then this can lead to an increased risk of heart attacks. And so we have had for many decades now something that helps inhibit cholesterol synthesis, and it's known as statins. And they've been shown to lower the heart attack risk, you know, by 29%. It really depends on the dose intensity. So that's been an important option for patients thus far. However, patients don't really like to take statins often, so the long-term adherence is actually quite poor. And, you know, this can be related to multiple barriers. One is side effects such as muscle pain, but it's also illustrative of a problem with chronic treatments, especially in examples where a patient might not feel very actively sick, right? They're doing this almost as a preventative measure to help lower risk of, you know, a heart attack down the road. Right, so it's difficult for a physician to keep their patients on these treatments. And so if you look at nature, right, we already have an example of something that could offer more durable protection. So there are individuals that are born with a particular loss of function variant in a particular gene. So you can just basically think of it as a non-functional gene. And this lowers, these patients will have lower levels of lipids and lower levels of coronary artery disease by about 30 to 40% without any evident health trade-offs. So in vivo editing, such an example from what CRISPR Therapeutics is developing, is basically aiming to replicate this protective profile just through a targeted one-time intervention. And even partial gene editing, you know, can translate to meaningful risk reduction, right? That's the premise. And so we describe in a blog post in more detail that we've published that basically if you can have, you know, about 70% inactivation of this gene, which is ANGPTL3, you could have a potential 52% reduction in coronary artery disease. And so this is really important. This is a fundamental shift potentially. And there's, you know, 26 million Americans just here in the US that have atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. What does that mean? It means you already have plaque buildup in your arteries, right? And so they are at higher risk of adverse events like heart attacks and morbidity. So many of these patients, about two-thirds of them, fail to reach their guidelines for lipid levels. And so these are what we're expecting to be likely the earlier adopters of such a treatment, in vivo gene editing treatment, that could lower your risk factors of something like bad cholesterol.
So what Shay, before we go into the big number portion of this market opportunity, can you dive into that 70%? Because this is the part where I was like, what? Where are we? What does this mean? And so it's like preclinical data demonstrated 70% efficiency for in vivo liquid nanoparticle delivered CRISPR in non-human primates. And then what, so is that where we are today, is not testing on humans? And then what is the log additive framework that converts over to how much, I think this was like around the 50% that could take hold among the people in this use case? Did I reframe those numbers correctly? And I was looking at what you wrote, so I said them, but I don't know what they mean.
That's fine. Let me take a step back. So basically, gene editing is not a perfect process. That's basically all you're saying. You're saying not every cell is going to be edited, right? Because it's not a perfect process. So you're saying, well, what if you had basically a 70% success rate in your editing? That's basically what that's getting at. And so they had non-human primates, so this just basically means, you know, not humans, data to show what is the level of editing efficiency. So how successful are they at actually making this particular edit? And so you can use that as basically like a benchmark. So if we know, you know, in nature, there are some people that are born with a loss of function variant in this particular gene, and they're heterozygous, meaning one copy is not functional and another copy is, that creates a benchmark so that you can say that it's 50% editing, right? So that's what you're benchmarking it to. So you're saying, well, this is 70%. What could that translate to in terms of risk reduction? So that's how that works, right? So if you have 50% efficiency, right, in nature, because I was heterozygous, meaning I had one of two non-functional copies of this gene, and I had a 41% reduction in my risk of coronary artery disease, what is the corresponding number if I was 70% editing of those cells? So that's basically the framework for how you're calculating in the model what the risk reduction is.
And that's why you could be relatively confident that, conditional on being able to deliver gene editing, you should be able to reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease, because you have this set of people out there. It's like 1 in 300 people who have like magical risk reduction to cardiovascular disease. And since it's the thing that's most likely to kill each and every one of us, like, we should want that. It's like, what, you know, and statins confers some of that benefit. But, you know, my dad, actually died of a stroke, was on statins, was off statins because the side effects were annoying to him, and it was just like diminishing his quality of life, and so he didn't adhere. And so you can imagine if instead you can cross a one-time, hey, I'm going to make a decision to give myself a lifetime's risk reduction against the thing that's most likely to kill me, that could be actually an extraordinarily attractive and successful product.
Yeah, and I think that's also what makes this such an interesting case study or example. We already have people that already live and have a loss of function variant. So it's nature's already done the experiment for you. We can already analyze these patients or these individuals and see that they have lower lipid levels, see that they have lower risk. And we're just trying to mimic that with this treatment.
So that's right. If evolution, if we didn't have all the other tech keeping suboptimal people alive, evolution would have taken hold and the non-stroke population would have thrive.
Well, maybe, I mean, it's actually interesting to think, you know, the reason that sickle cell disease exists is because malaria is so catastrophic that some tens of thousands of years ago in Africa, sickle cell disease developed to confer advantage against malaria. Because if you have sickle cell, then you are basically malaria protected. And so you would rather have the disease that kills you, you know, in decades, like median age of 50, I think, with sickle cell disease now, but but actually probably earlier back then, than malaria, which kills you in a couple years. And so there's, like, when you get into evolutionary biology, there's all kinds of, like, complicating factors. And you can say with at least some assurance, these people don't have to seem to have any deleterious effect to having this mutation. And they do, there's plenty of evidence that they're protected from cardiovascular disease.
All right, Shay, then what is the opportunity? Who's going to pay for it? And why will they pay for it?
Yes, so to answer that question, basically what we did is try and understand what the value-based price of such a treatment could be if it offers this benefit. So basically the way that we did that is develop a Monte Carlo simulation. So you can basically think of that as a computational method that uses repeated random sampling to model the probability of different outcomes, right? So that's what we did. And the value-based price that we arrive at is about $165,000, right? So to, you know, to answer your question earlier, Nick, you know, see how the prices differ, right? Casgevy is around $2 million in that particular indication. Here we're looking at, you know, from our modeling, our research, a potential value price of $165,000. But there's a lot of patients that could be potentially eligible for such a treatment, right? And so the ones we're concentrating on to have assessment or an idea of what that total addressable market is the ones we think that could be the earliest adopters, the ones that have the highest risk, right? So, you know, earlier I mentioned that there's 26 million individuals that have atherosclerotic disease, meaning they already have plaque buildup, they're already at higher risk of future adverse events like heart attacks. And two-thirds of them, you know, they have access to care, but they're still not hitting guideline goals for their lipid levels, right? So that's about 17 million patients, right? And so if you take 17 million patients and you multiply it by the value-based price of $165,000, what that means in terms of a total addressable market is $2.8 trillion. That's a really large number. So let's contextualize it, right? So, you know, one of the biggest blockbusters happened to be a statin named Lipitor. And over about 20 years, its cumulative sales is a little less than $250 billion, right? So basically what you're saying is if a in vivo gene editing treatment could capture just 8% or 1/12 of that TAM, it would match the blockbuster success that was Lipitor. So, you know, it's a really compelling opportunity, you know, obviously for CRISPR therapeutics and others that down the line will make in vivo gene editing treatments for other indications as well. But I think it highlights, you know, this is just one indication, just one example of an opportunity that could be developed with in vivo gene editing treatment. And I think that's really exciting, particularly.
And it's also just like interesting to think of commercially because, you know, you, in the work Shay did, she subsegmented to this population that already has plaque buildup. They're already clearly on the pathway to this becoming kind of mortal and impairing. And this is a way to kind of like hold them back from continuing on that pathway. But actually there's more value in giving this to someone when they're 25 or 30. So you don't build up those plaque at all. And the system isn't currently designed to underwrite, hey, we're gonna give you a treatment now so that when you're 70, you're not gonna die. You know, it's set up to be like, hey, you're about to die. We'll spend $500,000 to extend your life by, you know, a year and a half. And so that kind of, it almost, over time, I think that the way in which the health system is underwritten is gonna need to transform to accommodate these treatments. In the meantime, there's clearly like a huge market even in saying, well, I'm just giving this to the 17 million people who are kind of somewhere along the path at this underwritten price. Practically over time, after that market begins to unlock, the treatment should move kind of like earlier in people's lives at probably a lower price point because, you know, somebody that's at lower risk is less likely to have a heart attack. And so you're not conferring as much benefit, but you're doing it over a much broader population. And Lipitor was, you know, like, it's like one of the best selling drugs of all time in history. And it's something that was only 30% conferred, like, you know, 30% risk reduction. And a lot of people, you know, didn't stick on it. They would take it and then go off it, or they didn't get on in the first place. So it's a strong sign that there's actually, this market exists to do this and underwrite this.
Right. I think the question is, people always say 2.3 trillion. Okay, for that value-based pricing, is that taking unpriced externalities and putting a price on them? Or is it saying, you know, this is actually saving us money because we would have spent far more than this trying to keep you alive regardless. And then it's like to what you said, how is not the end state? Like, this is a $5,000 thing. Like, you want to stay alive, pay for it. We want you to stay alive. So, all right, all good. It's like, you know, it seems like the value based is temporal in that it's novel, but over, it's like we're already seeing it with like GLP-1 miracle drugs that are now riding an extremely steep cost decline curve, even though the value added benefit is probably much higher than what they're already charging.
Every health dollar spent is in some ways a budget choice where you're deciding whether or not to kill one person or another person. And so kind of commonly, you know, Medicare underwrites dialysis for diabetes patients principally. And that's like $100,000 per quality adjusted life year that you're delivering to the patient. So when we talk about kind of like the health economics of a drug, it's basically saying, well, there's a cutoff threshold at which we should be willing to spend an incremental dollar to deliver an incremental life year. And that's how the analysis is tuned. So Shay's taking kind of these late stage or kind of more at risk patient population saying, if we reduce their risk by 40%, you know, how many life years and quality adjusted life years do we save for those patients? And how much expense do we save, direct expense that they would otherwise incur? It's expensive to have a stroke and go to the hospital. And so there's some kind of, hey, we're extending people's lives. And there's some, hey, we're avoiding these other costs. And that should apply, you know, even as you go, I don't know if it would be $5,000, I think our analysis suggests actually materially higher because, again, this is like the number one killer. You can imagine even kind of like if you see here $160,000, you think, gosh, that sounds expensive. People often misunderstand it, but that's the one-time cost. Whereas a drug that's $10,000 a year, if you're going to live for 16 years, hey, there's $160,000. And so kind of the having this thing where you do a one-time threshold of like, oh, I don't have to worry about that nearly as much anymore, can be both a huge difference economically. It saves a bunch of direct costs down the road. And it doesn't, like, the sticker price isn't equatable to the sticker price for other drugs and treatments. So, Jay,
there you go. It's the same price as a $4 cup of coffee every day for 12 years.
Yeah. Exactly.
If may I ask one more question? What, like, in our most optimistic scenarios, assuming all of the data keeps coming in and everything is great, what is the timeline for a commercial rollout in like everything works from here on out? I know that's not how it works. It's not a perfect world, but what would that look like?
Sure. To ground this back to where it is today, so this is early phase one, right? So this isn't something I would expect by the end of the decade, probably early next decade. And the reason that I say that is right now we have really interesting and compelling new data that shows that in terms of lipid biomarkers, so looking at triglyceride levels, levels of bad cholesterol, you know, that you can see something as high as 80% reduction on top of standard of care. So that just goes to show how much wiggle room there was to still have lower lipid levels. But ultimately what you're gonna have to do is run this in more patients. And what you'd ultimately wanna see is there an actual reduction in adverse events, right? So adverse events like heart attacks, and that just takes time to evaluate and will take many more patients to evaluate it in. So it's early days, but really encouraging. And I think it's a really exciting opportunity.
And you kind of wonder, it's like, you know, if Joe Billionaire is there and being like, well, this seems like obviously a thing I should do, you know, there could be, who knows how kind of like the combination of commercials and regulatory factors and frictions is going to break here. But people who are kind of like, once you get abundantly wealthy, you want to live forever. And if people perceive this as a way to live more forever, they may pay out of pocket. And that would not be a necessarily easily commercially addressable opportunity from the company level, but it could provide, like, they could tap it to get, like, interesting kind of like broader patient pool for measuring kind of those adverse events. So it might provide an interesting data source that could at least accelerate things or potentially just solidify the evidence for what the treatments actually do.
All right, Shay, thank you for breaking that down.
Thank you.
We're out of time, but lots more on the space frontier that the debate rages on as to the economics of space-based data centers.
I think they underwrite basically flat, but the real assumption is it's like being able to generate a lot of tokens today versus a lot of tokens tomorrow is a strategic advantage for these companies, clearly. Like, that's why they're trying to build, you know, $500 billion of data centers in 5 years, not because that's like a way to efficiently allocate capital. It's because being 3 years behind in the space is death. And so from the perspective of like marginally penciling, but able to deliver much broader scale, then it actually maximally pencils. That's my...
I would agree with you, Brett, except for the proof is in the pudding with Meta, where they've tried to demonstrate that exact case, and the stock got crushed. As in, look, the payback period, but who are we to say that
the markets are efficient here?
Yeah.
And also, Meta has its super intelligence unit that is running up against the rocks of their existing franchise. Who's like, what are these idiots doing with all of our money? We wanted that money that we worked so hard generating off advertising to give back to shareholders. Why are they squandering it on this philosophical conceit of artificial superintelligence?
This ties into Mars broadly. It's like, what is the value of founding a new land? Is a clean slate, right? And it's like, if you look at power purchase agreements in the US, it's like the cost for energy, for renewable energy, which has a steep cost decline, has gone up like 2 to 3x. And it's like, why? Well, because clearly you can't ramp supply to meet demand. And so this is the actual price signal of people out there. And so it's like having the ability to control your destiny and build something when you need it is worth far more than the actual economics. And to what Brett's saying, the economics actually pencil out. So.
If
you have the price of electricity on one axis and the price of launch on the other axis, like as price of launch goes down, it favors space-based compute. As price of electricity on Earth goes up, it favors space-based compute. So, you know, you have to make some forward forecasts of those two things in order to figure out exactly where the pencil lies, call it. And the option value, I think, is something that's not quantifiable but is real.
All right. We'll see everyone next week, because Nick, even though he's going to be on vacation, is going to call in to join us.
Wow, really putting me on a blast here.
I'm also on vacation next week, too, so we'll see.
It's just going to be me monologue. Got it. Okay, great. I'm on vacation next week, too, so I don't know exactly what it's going
to
look like.
We have to do a year-end.
We may see everyone in the new year. That may be the case. There might be a surprise episode, but if not, we'll see you in the new year. Merry Christmas.
Also,
happy holidays.
Time chose AI as the person of the year. A huge blunder on our part, choosing Jensen.
Yes. Yeah.
But so it goes. All right. Shay, thank you again.
ARK Investment Management LLC is an SEC registered investment advisor. ARK, Wolf Financial, and Public are separate, unaffiliated entities and do not have a relationship with respect to any company marketing or selling the products or services of the others. ARK, Wolf Financial, and Public make no representation or warranties regarding and expressly disclaim any responsibility or liability for any acts, omissions, losses, or damages of the other entities or their affiliates, officers, employees, or agents. No company shall be liable for any indirect, incidental, consequential, or special damages arising out of or in connection with this podcast or its contents. The information provided in this show is for informational purposes only and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision and is subject to change without notice. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK, and investors should determine for themselves whether a particular investment management service is suitable for their investment needs. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK and or show guests and are not endorsements by ARK of any company or security or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this show may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARC's current views and assumptions and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statement. ARC assumes no obligation to update any forward-looking information. ARC and its clients, as well as its related persons, may, but do not necessarily, have financial interests in securities or issuers that are discussed. Certain information was obtained from sources that ARC believes to be reliable. However, ARC does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information obtained from any third party.